Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
On Casey.
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. I got Mr. Joe Goldberg writing.
I'm in the house.
Yeah, you're in the house. And
I'm staying out of the cold.
Yeah. Well, it's cold. It's been really warm in the house. In the back west here, it's been in the 70s every day. So.
Really? Where I am JT are from, it's not.
No? Oh, well, don't tell anyone.
yeah, it's not all over the national news about the cold and snow and rain in the Midwest.
You know? Yeah, because we and not only that, we don't want people coming to the West. I mean, we've got enough people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Got enough stuff going on here.
Maybe no one ever went that way anyway. Yeah. It hasn't been discovered yet.
No.
Well, hang tight, Joe, because in about 5 minutes, the sun is coming out, and you'll get that just a little bit south of me and where you are.
You're getting sun? Okay,
yeah.
I'll take that.
Yeah. It's your sun. I think you got the same sun about 10 minutes away.
All right, because I went down and did some shopping down your area, and I was getting poured on. Came home and got poured on, sprinkled on, and now hopefully if you tell me the sun is coming, I'll be sunny, I'll be happy. I'll be happy to talk to you about what you're doing in your life. It's been a while.
I'm happy about that.
Here comes the sun again.
Make that a song.
Yeah, I think that could be a song. But we're not talking about sunny, bright things here. You've got a New Orleans Haunts series, and this is book one, Brothers of Blood. So let's talk about this. So you've kind of changed your direction from being a thriller writer, let's say, into kind of getting into more of a darker, or let's just say, kind of writer. Is there a reason why you've gone that way? Are you out killing people or something? Or
yeah, Joe pushed me right out of the market with his books. They're so good. Like,
sorry,
screw this.
Here.
I am out.
I got in because of you. Right?
No, I know. Jack Carr is on. You know, he's begging for money now. He's hanging out.
Yeah.
He's,
Goldberg, you know, stop it! Stop writing those non-bestsellers.
He's taking them all out.
Well, I'd like to think that I've always been writing horror and that I'm still writing thrillers, but the military and espionage thing, I just felt like I needed to back away from a little bit. Joe knows that the pre-publication review can be a little bit daunting, and if you've got a publisher who has deadlines, they don't always coincide with the government. And so if you're having to do Department of Defense and the intelligence community to get your things approved, sometimes they can turn it around in 2 weeks. Sometimes they can turn it around in a year. And if they, you know, fight between the two of them and say these things should be redacted, I've usually been pretty good about not calling no contest. I'll cut out whatever you want, but unfortunately sometimes the timelines of resubmission and all that don't line up. And so we had a few blown releases, and I really enjoy reading some darker horror stuff anyway. And so I decided, well, let me try my hand at this, and I've been having a lot of fun.
Right. So now we're talking to author J.T. Patton, just so people that don't know. I mean, I don't know who wouldn't know who you were, but
he prefers the J.T.
Just my mom, my kids, they know who J.T. is, but
everybody
else.
Hopefully someday. Yeah, well, I heard Stephen King sent me a message saying that he'd like to talk to you because he wants to learn how to write like you.
I got to tell you, I'll tell you a funny, sometime if we have time today, I'll tell you a real kind of funny story about Stephen King and how it even got me into horror.
Oh, well no, go for it. We want to hear this.
Lock and load.
Well, I was a young lad of 12, probably, and hanging out at my friend's for a sleepover. And sleepovers back in the day usually meant watching some Son of Sven Gulli, getting a Tombstone pepperoni pizza, and looking through his porn collection. And I remember us all being in there, a bunch of guys being in the room going through the stack, and I looked at this thing that it was an article by Stephen King in Penthouse. And it had a really creepy cover on it, and I started reading it, and the guys were saying, well, come on, it's my turn to look at this one, and blah, 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 and I went in the other room, and I'm reading this thing, and his mom came out and saw me there, and she says, what are you doing with that? And I said, I'm reading the articles.
Yeah, nobody reads the articles. Nobody believes that. Come on.
And I turned over. I said, I've never heard of this author. Have you? And she said, Stephen King. She goes, I've got two books if you'd like to read those instead. I said, yeah, that's fine. And so she introduced me to, I think it was Cujo was the first one, and Carrie, I think, was the other one that she let me borrow. So it was kind of an odd happenstance that could have, well, it was pretty awkward, but she immediately just kind of recognized that I actually was interested in what Stephen King had to say about what scares him. So yeah, that gave me an early start.
He probably held up the picture and said, what's this?
Yeah, that's right? A likely story. So he sent a letter to Guccione saying, thanks, Bob.
I am sticking to it.
But, you know, you went to horror. We were both thriller guys, espionage guys. Yeah. And you, I'm spinning to suspense. You're spinning toward, you're doing horror.
Yeah.
What was it about, I mean, overall, about horror that made it more interesting than suspense or psychological or historical fiction or something? Well, you are kind of historical fiction.
I still do like the historical aspects of it. I definitely felt like, okay, I had to move away from anything that was, you know, sensitive, top secret, anything trade crafty. I also realized that as I was moving further and further away from the military community, intelligence and such, you know, I forgot a lot and things had changed. And so I was having to research as much of that as anyone else. So not only am I researching it, but then because I discovered it, then I can't put it in there. I've also never been, you know, I still write some, you know, gun reviews and things in magazines, but I've never been a gun guy per se. And so having to research a lot of that for authenticity, because you, as you know, on the military side, it is, you know, people are very discerning about everything from range to caliber to, you know, just about anything you can imagine. I found that obviously with horror, that's very forgiving. And the more abstract that you can get on that, sometimes even the better. And so I thought that I was able to use my imagination a little bit more. I also felt like, you know, being a Stephen King fan, the books were, you know, my time is short, as is a lot of other people. And I felt like I couldn't commit or didn't want to commit to a 700-page book anymore, any more than I would a Tom Clancy these days. And I felt like maybe there's a real good opportunity for, you know, there are horror readers who love Stephen King, Shirley Jackson, and they like some of those real long ones. Then there's also the thriller readers who are more thriller movie buffs that just like to be scared, like to see some, you know, get some thrills, but they need it done in an hour and a half, 2 hours. And a lot of those people would rather not read a 500 or 700 page book. And so I felt like there was also a pretty good market out there, especially for those that might read a novella. If I could take the pacing of a thriller, turn it into a horror novel, which was more of that roller coaster ride, not necessarily with the jump scares, but let's tell a fast story, get you wrapped up in it, get your emotions going. And I thought maybe that would be kind of fun for some people that wouldn't otherwise read horror books.
Well, you just had two of my questions in one. Let's go with the second question I had in my head, which is, how do you pace out from even a regular 350-page, 80,000-word book to 50,000 or less? Yeah. How do you cram it in there? What are the things that you're leaving in and taking out?
I'm taking out a little bit of the backstory. I'm taking out some of the detail, and sometimes in horror, less is more. And so I think sometimes you can get away with not being as gruesome as you might be, you know, very visual in some other thrillers. So I think that helps. I also think that a lot of times with traditional thrillers, espionage, we do it over like longer periods of time. And in this case, I think you by its very nature, you kind of compress what's happening in a horror story, because you have to build that suspense and you can't just drag it on for weeks later, you know, type thing. So I think because we are already compressing it, I set myself to be, you know, about 35,000-40,000 words. That equates to about 20 chapters. I really just try to back it out to where your climax would be, subclimax. Maybe you've got a couple different layers in there, and then move that to the front. So I do find that I no longer am writing by the seat of my pants. I do structure it a lot more than I ever did before.
So let's talk about the premise of this series as well as the book. So what are people going to get? What is it you're hoping to put out?
So for this series, I'm doing a number of them, which are kind of the bigger picture is city haunts. And in this first grouping, I'm doing New Orleans haunts. And so I'm centering on about five or six different New Orleans legends and folklore. I'm taking the historic element, kind of compressing it into the very first part of the book, and then I'm expanding on it to be either the root of the tale, maybe a little bit more behind the mystery, or taking something that seems so fantastical, and then how do we make it plausible based on science, history, etc. So the first book that I wrote was Brothers of Blood. And that centers on the story of the Carter brothers, who were considered vampires in the 20th century. And is about 1920s, roughly. And they were two brothers that had a flat in the French Quarter. And somebody had escaped. Police, you know, tracked down where this girl was saying that it all had happened. They went upstairs and found people bound to chairs. They found some people dead in another room, and they had been drinking their blood. The boys escaped. They claimed that they had superhuman strength. They were later captured by the docks where they had worked like a day or so later. They were executed. And then the legend is that they return. So there's bits and pieces of true history, then a lot of fable to it. And so what I did is I tried to put together what would happen if this was actually true, and how do we craft that story around the area, what was happening at the time culturally. Were they vampires with an I, where they're actually, you know, the living dead drinking blood, or were they vampires with a Y, which was they weren't necessarily immortal, but they were drinking blood, and maybe they were just serial killers. And so that's essentially what the book is and how it plays out. And then I weave in some other things like witchery that was going on, hoodoo, voodoo, and even the history of the Axeman, who was a serial killer at the time also, and kind of wove that into the tale.
How do you select which ones you're going to put into this tale? Which ones do you bring in? There's a lot of history there in New Orleans.
There really is. I tried to do some good old Joe and Scott agency analysis on what is most popular, and vampires are the most popular. So we started with that. The next one, Howl of the Hunted, is about werewolves, or the Rougarou in the Swamp Bayou there. So I went with that next. So I'm doing it based on where there is usually a lot of uptake for horror books. And then I also do it based on when you go to New Orleans, which are the things that they speak about the most in the tours and things that people want to see, and where are the ghosts and such like that. So that's what I'm doing, and I think the next two should fall right in line with that as well. And so I'm hoping that somebody who reads it will like it and want to go to the next. Plus, the way that I lay it out, either historically or geographically in New Orleans, they're short novellas, so you're talking 3.5-4 hours to read or listen to. Perfect if you're coming from Chicago and going out for a little vacation there. It also uses enough landmarks that you could literally create your own tour and follow this book along with the other like kind of ghost stories and legends. So you can, you know, take a few days after reading and go around the city and see all of those different sites, which I think is also kind of unique. It's a little, you know, do your own story.
Well, the obvious question is, and you're not from New Orleans, right? So I'm assuming you went down there, lived, did whatever you did to become, to soak in the atmosphere, to understand the culture over time of New Orleans. How'd you do that? What did you do?
Bro, I am a Chicago Cajun at heart.
I know. Okay.
Close enough. So my grandmother was from the South. She was from Arkansas. So we spent most of our summers down South. And I grew accustomed and loved Southern cooking, a lot of comfort food. I loved seafood. And so as I, you know, grew a little bit older and with spice, I found just a real love for Cajun food, cooking it, eating it, what have you. I had to spend some time down there for work a number of years ago, and it was in Lafayette for months. Loved that. Went to New Orleans, loved that. And so whenever I have an opportunity to go back to New Orleans, I just love being there. It feels, I don't want to say it feels like home, but it feels like a place that I want to be. And so I spent a lot of time talking to the people. I've driven so much of it by just renting a car and going into the swamps, going into the backcountry and going to find, you know, the dumpiest looking shack and hoping to find some awesome fried catfish and some gumbo in those places. So it feels very comfortable. So I figured that's a great place to start because of that history and a legend. And I think just walking around in French Quarter at night, you know, you got that air of danger, and you know, it feels to me like a safe place to find and be around danger and that type of stuff. And it's sweetness.
Did you practice being a vampire to figure out how?
Next question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bloody JT, Bloody Mary.
Yeah. Yeah, I think from that standpoint, it was kind of fun to work the serial killer angle in. I think the other aspect of it, and if you read the book, you'll see that the front cover deals a lot with like kind of a psychological warning. And I took the premise of before you become a vampire, if you're being truly groomed by a vampire, you know, they're discreet. So how would you groom somebody? How would you get this done? And it's basically a series of brainwashing. So I took a lot of our old interrogation, manipulation and those techniques. And there's roughly, you know, I'd say a core 10 or 12 that you do to break somebody down to be in their power. And that's really where my chapters are even labeled. So I thought that was kind of fun also because you could take this whole psychological thing of really without having to just bite somebody's neck a few times and then they're turned, but over the series of time to manipulate them and psychologically just abuse them to be your minion. I thought that was kind of fun, but I also did it not as like public service, but I felt like a lot of young teenage girls may end up reading a book like this. So I tried not to make it too graphic. I tried not to use too much profanity. I don't know there's much at all in there. Because I thought it might be good for some people to read it and find if they could recognize that they're in that situation right now with other adults, other individuals. And I thought that was kind of cool too, by not making it a manual, but making it a very subtle thing that somebody could read and be like, oh, shit.
Oh, my.
This is what's going on to me. And then realizing that, you know, they could find themselves in a little bit of problem, you know, not necessarily to become a vampire, but of course, you know, some cases just worse.
Well, are there topics inside the horror overall genre, vampire subset, and even content language that you said, oh, this is okay, this is book worthy, or no, this goes too far?
No, I don't think I really looked at that. I think it's pretty brutal. I think I kept it. It's for adults. I try to keep it a little bit young adult, and I think I was still able to convey where that manipulation would occur, where abuse could occur, without it being gratuitous in a way that somebody might say, well, that is completely inappropriate. You're reading a horror book, and so I try to work within those bounds as well of expectations. I mean,
oh my!
You watch half of those vampire TV shows. I mean, they're ripping off heads, splitting necks, and stuff like that. And so there's not too much. And that's on, you know, the WB or whatever those channels are. And so I think there's a lot of give, a lot of area to work in.
How did you get into the mindset of the brothers? Or did you write it from their point of view?
I did. It was the first time that I've done first person. And I really wanted to stray away from any Anne Rice stuff. I didn't love Interview with a Vampire and how it was done. And so I think that also made me think, I'm wanting to stay away from it. Why? Because it seems hard and because it's been done. What if I do it because it's hard and do it in a way that's not been done? And that's what I did then. So I did it from one of the brothers' vantage points. And I think because of that, so he being a victim, in some cases, he didn't recognize what was happening. And so you could see it from other points of view, whereas he's still a little bit oblivious to it. And maybe it's obvious to others. So that was a bit of a stretch for me, but I think it turned out okay. I think if I had to criticize myself a bit, maybe it slowed down the pacing a bit, but if you enjoy a psychological thriller and a telling of tales that's a little bit narrative in somebody's perspective, I think somebody would enjoy it.
How much of the real case did you use?
Well, there isn't that much out there. And as you can imagine, it's got a lot of holes. So I try to put together how those holes could have fit. So, for example, you know, there's no record of the Carter brothers ever being executed. Well, there were some Le Cartier. And so could that have changed over time, or could they have changed their name at some point in time? I also figured out, well, if they were real vampires, how would that have fit in? Well, there was another guy, a count that lived, you know, about 20 years earlier, that there was some tell of, you know, him being a vampire. Well, what if he didn't die? There is some actual fact that an individual like that existed. So I try to sew that together. I think similarly, that Axeman story, you know, there's not a lot there because the MO seemed very different. How the people were killed, you know, was still by an axe, but sometimes they found that people had bare feet that had been trespassing. Sometimes they had picked the lock. Other times they broke a lock. Other time they went in through a window. And so it told me, from more of that true crime perspective and investigations, maybe it's not the same person. So if I looked at who was being killed, well, that was a lot of Irish grocers. Well, who would have been brutal enough to do that, that would have multiple people willing to do it? Well, lo and behold, about that same time, the Irish marketers were being pushed out by the Italian immigrants. That French market area was dwindling, and the Irish had set up an area of brothels, clubs in this area called the Swamp. But they were being pushed out, and that was becoming a lot more. They're knocking those buildings down, and people were moving to an area called Storyville. And if I was an Italian or an Irish mobster, I'd be pretty pissed off about it. And so I tried to fit that in also, of these being really revenge killings because of an inter-ethnic conflict. And I thought that made it, you know, a lot more plausible. And I also thought maybe that even sheds a lot of light into the existing mystery.
So what is it you hope a reader would take away from this? Is this just pure horror, haunts, scary? You know, be scared of you.
Yeah, I think it's, I'd like to think of it as somebody who's interested in travel, somebody who's interested in history, that likes a good scare book. People who like shows like American Horror Story, I think would eat this up. All of them are fairly different. They start out the same, where the first chapter is kind of the legend, a little bit of a historic view that's you know, created in like a real life setting. And then it goes into the new part. So it's fresh. It's not just a retelling of it. The second book that is now just out in audio, it's not out in print yet. We're trying to get a publisher to take a look at these. So my agent's shopping around, but the audio is out there. And I will say that's probably one of the most brutal books that I have ever written, because you're talking about, you know, werewolves in a swamp. And I examined the alpha a little bit more, and how an alpha might be. And in this case, you know, why you would change the legend nature. It covers a lot of indigenous legends that mix in with some of the hoodoo also out there. So I think, again, a person that's not just looking for a thrill, although they'll find one in it, but something a little bit deeper, that's looking for just some kind of cool history stuff to latch onto and maybe even geek out a little bit and search it up a bit. I mean, we got some stuff about like the Chickasaw tribe and burial grounds and stuff. And, you know, who doesn't love a good burial ground, you know? So I think I just try to put in there things that I'd like to read.
So is the world outside the original first chapter legend all your world that you've, the total fiction story, but the people that they're interacting with, the places those are imagination?
No, I try to do it as historic as possible without getting in trouble.
So it's historical fiction.
Yeah, so like, and so that's where I make it like the plausible part. So if you go to New Orleans tomorrow and you're walking around, and then maybe you see some kind of homeless guys around, maybe they're strung out drugs, you know, they got the yellow jaundiced eyes. Well, what if those were the old werewolves that had, you know, already changed, done their penance, and so now they're just around the streets? And so what I want to create is something that is so authentic that as you are walking around New Orleans with all these hidden secrets, I want people to see ghosts. I want them to look and say, holy crap, do you think? How about that person? What about this? This could be real. And I want it to enhance the experience when they're in whatever these cities are, because I want it to feel so real that as you're walking around, you feel like you have kind of uncovered some of the secrets of what actually happened. If you go down to the French Market, I want you to look around and say, holy crap, there are a lot of grocery stores in that area. That's probably why that happened. Or if you're going to see the Vampire Cafe and you look out to the third floor, that's where the Carter brothers were. So it's a real experience. And I think I just hope to contribute to what already exists there, but just put a new spin, put a little fresh coat of paint on it.
And so with the witchcraft and some of the, like you were mentioning, hoodoo and voodoo and stuff like that, how do you fit that in? Like what level of that is in the story?
I think, again, a little bit of self-interest. I did research a lot of hoodoo, a lot of the old spells, a lot of the natural remedies and stuff to put that together, because I personally, I don't know about you guys, but if I'm watching some type of a movie and there's like witchcraft, I expect them to be speaking in some tongues or different language or something. I want some authenticity in there. And I want to know if that's really a rat they're putting in, a bat wing, whatever that stuff is, and why that is. So I try to incorporate all of that in instead of just like a hocus pocus, oh, the witch cast a spell. I mean, I want this person to be gnarly, and I want, if somebody sees that I'm putting in sage and tarragon and earthworms and lighting a black candle and turning it upside down, I want somebody who might even practice it or research it to be like, that is the
shit. Oh, my.
So I think it's just, you know, trying to be as authentic as I would if I had to say that's a magazine or a clip on a 9mm, and making sure that I'm getting things right, from velocity to grains of gunpowder, etc. But this is more fun for me.
Yeah. Did you actually practice, you know, did you throw in the frog legs and all that stuff? And
Got my son sitting right here. He's a duck. So
deep fried bat.
I'll be damned how I'm going to get him back, but it's okay.
Yeah. Watching Bewitched reruns, right? And do all
right?
That. Mindset of the characters. There's quite a bit. You, when you're writing your thriller and espionage and stuff, your characters have a different tone about them, right? Than you're doing with two brothers that are in this situation. So how do you get into that mindset, or do you find it difficult, or do you like writing it better?
Well, I, you know, maybe I'll tee this one up for Joe a little bit. I do like writing from the mindset, but I think as both he and I have had to do some political analysis and doing some targeting on individuals and getting into the mindset of how they would act, you know, Hunt for Red October, you know, the analyst is a Jack, what the hell is his last name? But
Ryan.
Jack Ryan. You know, he's got to get in the mindset of Sean Connery. So, I mean, Joe, wouldn't you say that that's kind of helped you in a lot of your writing too, of just when you've had to analyze an individual and think like them, it kind of comes a little bit naturally after a little bit when you really get to know them, would you say?
Yeah, that I agree. And it was a lot easier for me on the espionage thriller side. And I just use this line talking to my daughter about creating my suspense. As I said to her, my character's not talking to me. And she kind of went like, what? And I said, I can't hear her yet. I can't, she's not telling me who she is and what she is and how I, and what I need to feel, what she's saying. And I'm getting closer, but I'm building this character. I have templates, right? I know what this kind of person should be doing, but I want this person to talk to me. And that's what that's getting inside their head, right? That's anticipating their action, knowing what they're thinking. And it's impressive that, well, you were an expert at it. This was your thing. It's that you can get into the minds of, I don't know, a vampire or a person in horror, as opposed to what somebody would say is a functioning person in the real world. So how did you do that? Get it? Because, I mean, first of all, they're not legend, but they're historical fiction characters, and there's really nobody to talk about now, and as you said, there's limited research on them. How did you do it?
I just try to embody if I were in that situation and putting it in. Al, have you found when, I know with your experience in researching criminals and murderers, I don't know to the extent that you've done a lot of the interviews with them, but I mean, I think after a while, don't you kind of feel like you can kind of see from their eyes?
To an extent, like when you, it's kind of hard. It's not, when I go into a room with a killer, especially one that's done quite a few killings, I tend to be not believing of what they're coming across, you know, what they say, what they do. I'm on the downside there, so I don't walk in thinking I'm going to get a lot of knowledge from what they say. So yeah, so probably their emotions or their eyes would be more accurate than a lot of times their voice.
And one of the main vampire-ish guy in this story, I think, kind of goes along to what Al's saying of, I don't trust that guy for sure.
Oh my.
So I think that's part of it also, where, you know, you may have a very misleading individual and you can put down the words, but you can also get inside of that head saying that's what he's trying to do, and through the manipulation and stuff. And so I think it's just, you know, there's a lot of grace to that too, because really who's going to challenge you? As long as you're just trying to be authentic to the time period, some of the language and the thoughts. And as long as you're kind of consistent along your plot, you know, that's creative writing. There's a pretty wide berth.
Because when you meet someone in prison, they've been caught for their crime. They're in manipulation mode. It's what can they get from you, and what do you want to hear from them? Do you know what
yep.
I mean?
Yeah.
And they'll make that happen even if it's not true, because it's something that they want. So it takes a long time to sort of really get things from someone, if that makes sense, rather than, it's not quite like it is on TV where they walk in and then they have the whole thing laid out for them. You know what I mean?
I do. And I think it's very similar to developing intelligence sources. I mean, when you're developing assets, you know, you're asking somebody to cheat on what they're doing. So, you know, by the very nature, they have to be deceptive to somebody. And if that's in their nature, they could be to you also. So how do you balance that? So I think there's a lot of that, a lot of some fun stuff in there with the character building, which again gives you, could they be lying? Could they not? And hopefully that comes across also to the readers. Just, you know, that's part of the mystery.
Well, that's, I think what we're talking around, and I've sort of been focusing on, is you have characters that you have from historical fiction. You've built them out in your new creation of legend. You have the plot of what they did, the plot that you're creating, and you have the setting of New Orleans. So how did you balance that out? What do you want the reader to say? Oh, I remember the Carter brothers. Oh, I remember the New Orleans. Oh, I remember vampires. What are they walking away with?
Yeah, I think they're walking away with, we know that there's vampire legend in New Orleans, and because of how I structured the vampires in this story, it could be more real, or it could be more dangerous, knowing that even if they're not the undead, maybe they're that type of fanatics, and maybe that is how some people just get taken and murdered. And I think that's where bridging the fantastic with the horrific is what I want. So I want them to walk away testing themselves on being scared. And what are they afraid of? Are they afraid of the undead or getting dead by actual humans?
Yeah. I'm afraid of reading Stephen King in a Playboy.
Or getting caught.
I was busy reading Catcher in the Rye back then.
I've never seen a rye in Playboy or Penthouse.
That's true. Hey, JT, are the series only connected by location? I mean, there's content horror, but the stories themselves are standalone stories?
So, yes, these are standalone. And so, like, the werewolf one, the Rougarou, that is actually more present time, whereas the other one does remain set in the past. I think the other ones are also a little bit more present. I've got some flip-flop on one that deals with some of the pirates in the area and a curse. You could sew them all together, but no, I like to keep them short stories so someone can feel like it's a one and done, but they'll still get the next the same type of a feel going to the next. And that's why I made it so that first chapter, the prologue, always starts you off with, let me tell you the legend, kind of. And so you know that that's going to happen. Now, where's it going to take me? That's that next, hopefully, bit of excitement. After I finished New Orleans, then ideally, depending on, you know, the publisher, you know, that'll depend on where we go next with the series, and or if we just expand and kind of knock out a whole bunch of the New Orleans ones. I mean, I think you can make, obviously, short stories and novellas are really great for making adaptations to streaming TV. And so you could definitely make this episodic, make some series over them, whether you combined them, separated them, whatnot. So, you know, I'd be lying if I wasn't saying that I also try to make it convenient for an adaptation if you know, Hulu, Sci-Fi, whatever, Netflix wanted to pick something like that up and, you know, have their own type of American horror type series. And it would be very fresh.
Lifetime.
Yeah.
Oh, it isn't.
It's Hallmark. It's Hallmark.
It's Hallmark. It's the dub channel's version of the Blood and... Are all three books available now, or is it a three book in one, or how does this work?
So right now, so what happened is I published Brothers of Blood very quickly. I had written it for my wife. Her 50th birthday was coming up. Did I say that, or 35? Was coming up. Wanted to get it out there. Had somebody doing the audio, so I just, you know, put it out. So that is available paperback, ebook, and audio. I think it's like $2.99 or $4.99 for Kindle some right now. Then after I finished The Howl of the Hunted, Tantor had reached out to me. They wanted the rights to a bunch of the books, but we were doing them like one or two at a time. They did the audio for it. I was getting ready to publish it. I picked up a literary agent who had been nice enough to respond to my query. She signed me, and then she's like, hang on, don't publish these things because obviously somebody's not going to want to buy a whole series of already published books. So that's where I'm not sure if they're going to split it up or how they're going to do it. If they're going to leave Brothers of Blood alone and then maybe just publish these other ones, I don't know yet. But I know that the uptake has been great. So I'm continuing to write them, and we'll, you know, give it a few months, see if somebody picks them up. If not, I am more than happy to self-publish them and get them out into the wild as soon as possible. So if that's the case, the third and fourth books should be forthcoming. And then that second werewolf book, like I said, it's written. It's just a matter of either having a publisher take it, edit it again, and you know, recover it and put it out there, or if I'll end up doing it if they want me to do something different. So one, so you could read one now, you could listen to the second one, and the second one, this guy Eric Smees, who does the audio, I actually grew up with the guy. He does such a great job with accents and shifts of voices. So it's I really find that you know, I enjoy reading or listening to them on walks with the dogs, even though I've already written the story, and I'm still kind of waiting to hear what's next, because he just does such a nice job. So I highly encourage it. He's done both of those books, so yeah, he does a good job.
Fantastic. Now, do you have a website then, or social media? Where do people find JT Patton?
Usually see JT Patton sitting down having some barbecue with Joe.
Barbecue, but, that's right.
It's been a while.
Wow. It's my turn to buy. That's why it's been a while.
I almost everything I have is branded JT Patton Books. So I've got a website, JT Patton, P-A-T-T-E-N, not O-N like the general, books.com. And then I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, X, whatever you call it. And these books can all be found on Amazon, or you can just you know, do a quick Google. I'm not so busy that someone can't just email me anyway, because I'll respond pretty quick.
Well, there you go. See, he's available. JT is waiting for
he's
you.
Wide open.
Wide
he's
open.
Open and, book.
Yeah, sitting in New Orleans waiting with a
vignette and cream. Teeth. Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe after Stephen King gets a laugh out of the story when you talk to him about it, you know, he just ring me up and we'll just put something together. You know, I don't even need to call his people. He doesn't need to call my people. We'll just make it happen.
Yeah,
Nimble. His ghostwriter.
Nimble.
He can come over for one of Joe's barbecues, you know, and
anytime.
That's right. We'll take him to a baseball game. He likes baseball.
Anyway, the book, Brothers of Blood, okay, and it's book one of the New Orleans Haunts. And J.T. Patton, author, been our guest. Thank you.
Thank you so much, guys. Appreciate it, Al. Good to see you. Talk to you again, Joe. Catch up soon.
Thanks, man.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com. You've been listening to the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, all shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.